Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thanks for downloading, subscribing, rating. Coming up on this week's show, it's a really good one. We're going to be speaking to James Nestor about his research into the power of our breath and how breathing has an enormous effect on our health, our mood, and even the shape of our face. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end of the show. First up, it's time to look back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and medic and immunologist Dr. Laura Duncan. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Laura, has to do with babies and spina bifida.
It does, yeah. Sometimes these stories come along and I just think, God, isn't science and medicine just absolutely amazing? So most people in Ireland will have heard of spina bifida. It's increasingly rarer now. About 40 babies a year are born with it. And it's a neural tube defect. So effectively, where our brain and our spinal cord are in our body should close over and then skin grows over it. But in babies with spina bifida, it often doesn't close over properly. And sometimes it's quite severe. So the nerves and effectively spinal cord protrude out of the lower back. And obviously that can cause serious damage to the nerves and lots of ongoing problems, bladder control, bowel control, walking. So what the standard of care is now and has been for at least 15 years is that they do in utero surgery, which is fascinating. So they open up the mother's abdomen, then they open a small hole in the uterus itself. Then they spin the baby around so that the part of the back that is affected is at the hole in the uterus. And they basically surgically stitch up the defect in the neural tube or in the spine. And it's even that alone is phenomenal. But what they've done in this very, very small trial, granted it was only six babies, is that they have taken stem cells from placentas, now not from the mother's placenta, from donated placentas. And they've grown up these stem cells effectively on a little matrix. So it's sort of like a stem cell plaster. Which is what my children would be able to relate to. So what these surgeons are doing now is before they finally close the upper layers, they're taking the stem cell plaster and they're laying it on the defect and then closing up around it. Now, this happened in 2021, 2022 for these six babies. So we have a few years of data now on them. And it has shown improved outcomes. So there has been better control in terms of bladder, bowel, and they're more likely to walk. So it's very much proof of principle just to see that it's safe, that it didn't cause tumors, that it didn't cause any infections. But it's just, it's fascinating. I mean, the surgery alone is fascinating, but now adding in the stem cells, it's just, it's amazing, groundbreaking stuff.
You said it's increasingly rare. Why is that?
So a lack of folic acid is one of the primary causes of children being born with neural tube defects. And almost everybody now does take their folic acid. So it would have been something that was much more common, you know, certainly 100 years ago and definitely 50 years ago. And in certain parts of the world, there is things like flour that has folic acid in it. And some women just take folic acid at all stages when they're still potentially able to conceive. So it's increasingly rare as a result of that, but it does still happen.
Right. Okay. So that's what the folic acid is for. Okay. Very, very interesting. It's great to, you know, it's a simple intervention that most people can take advantage of. It's so effective that we're seeing nearly the end of a condition like spina bifida. But this is an amazing result. Did the researchers say anything about being hopeful that this might, you know, completely reverse spina bifida, or is that just not a mission goal?
Yeah, I suppose the thing is, damage is done. By the time that the baby is large enough to be operated on, the spine, the nerves have been outside of the spine for long enough that they've been exposed to amniotic fluid, they've been exposed to forces within the uterus. So it's going to be very hard to completely reverse this, and you can't operate when they're really tiny, obviously because they're really tiny. So it's not a perfect outcome, but one would hope that it would give a better outcome than surgery alone, which is already a pretty good outcome.
Amazing. That's fantastic. Ruth, our second story has to do with hair regrowth.
Yeah, I mean, millions and billions of euros and pounds must have been spent on products for people trying to either get their hair to grow back or maybe not to grow in certain places. So we have a particularly strong relationship with our hair. But in reality, when it comes to hair loss, I mean, it affects millions of people, whether it's, you know, alopecia or premature balding. And we don't really have any good treatments for it. I mean, I guess, you know, people will have heard of drugs like minoxidil, which is in things like Rogaine, and then people will have heard of hair transplants. So those are kind of the options that are on the table at the moment. But this is a different approach to thinking about hair growth, because it's about thinking about what's going on in the immune system around hair follicles. And hair follicles, I suppose, they're almost like a mini organ, each little follicle. And it goes through a cycle of growth. So there's the anagen phase where the hair is growing. Then there's a regression phase where it sort of just stops. And then there's a rest phase called the telogen phase. And what happens with baldness is the follicles sort of get stuck in that rest phase. And it's really, really hard to get them to turn back on again. So this research sort of takes two strands that we already knew. One was this idea that the immune environment around hair follicles might make a difference. And the other one is this idea of using something called cold atmospheric plasma. And plasma is a gas where the particles have been activated. So plasma is, you know, what we see in lightning, for example, when we see activated particles in the atmosphere. But we have seen that cold activated plasma can help with wound healing, because essentially those activated particles can stimulate the immune system to start working. So researchers in Korea put these two things together. It's definitely not drug free. It feels like it's quite a big intervention. But they injected a drug, interleukin-2, just under the surface of the skin. Interleukin-2 is an immune signaling molecule which tells things like T cells to replicate.
I've heard that of that before. It's used in other treatments, right? Interleukin-2?
It is. I mean, it's a sort of common signaling molecule in the immune system that would be targeted in lots of different pathways. But then they used cold plasma to turn the liquid that they had injected into sort of a soft gel inside the skin. So it was sort of a slow release treatment to change the immune system. And what they found was, and they sort of weren't trying to force the hair to grow, they were trying to turn it back into this growth phase. And they did a whole lot of tests, as scientists do, you know, in petri dishes and things, and they could see that the immune cells were being turned back on. So then they moved to the scientists' favorite, the mice, and they removed the hair from the back of mice. And then they did this treatment, and they were able to see that in the control group, you know, it took much, much longer for the hair follicles to turn back on and regrow. And actually, the mice that got this treatment, within 2 weeks, their backs, where all the hair had been removed, it had all grown back. So it is also the one of those terms where this is promising, but it's very much still in the lab, and yeah, it is quite complicated. I mean, it's not.
You want to be very careful about, you know, about turning that machine on. You want to make sure that it doesn't overdo its job.
Absolutely, yeah. You don't overstimulate the immune system, but I think, you know, this kind of work, it's more probably about the understanding of a hair follicle as a mini immune environment. And you all, you know, as with many things in science, maybe this won't be the therapy that people will get, where they get an interleukin-2 injected and then cold plasma onto their head.
It sounds quite like quite a lot. I was just thinking, it's not something you're going to find on a shelf.
No, not this week.
Yeah. And you know, as Ruth kind of pointed to, obviously, yeah, it kind of feels like there's a disproportionate amount of money and research that goes into hair loss, but there obviously are some people for whom it is problematic. So it's, you know, it would be helpful in those situations. It's not just a vanity thing, but that, you know, if we look at the numbers of what goes into that versus some other things, it is kind of crazy. Lara, a third story has to do with prostate cancer. And again, another very interesting result.
It really is. These are great stories today. This is a story that's just come from a conference over in San Francisco. So it's not a peer-reviewed study yet, but it looks very promising. It's a phase one trial of 58 men in the US who got this brand new drug. Now, it's quite a complex drug. A lot of people these days have now heard of immunotherapy. So it's the immune system's version of chemotherapy for cancer. So you use the immune system's ability to kill cancer cells rather than a sort of blunt instrument that is chemotherapy. And the next phase of that is what we call bispecific antibodies, and they're fascinating. So this antibody binds to a killer T cell. A killer T cell's job is to kill the cancer cells, and then it takes the killer T cell with it, and the other part of the antibody binds to the cancer cell. So it physically brings them into very close proximity, and the killer T cell can then kill the cancer cell. So it sounds very simple, but it is so advanced and so fascinating, but it hasn't been working very well for solid tumors. So solid tumors are things that are not lymphomas and leukemias. So, you know, esophageal cancer, prostate cancer, those kind of things.
So just out of interest, we talk about that in a way that I'm wondering, does that actually translate to what actually the tumor feels like? Is a hard tumor actually physically hard, or is that nothing to do with it?
No, it's not really anything to do with it, because a lung tumor would be quite squishy and soft, whereas say prostate cancer, it would be a bit harder. But no, good question. But no, it's more just to do with the fact that they're not circulating. Obviously, okay. They can become metastatic and they circulate. But anyway, that's an aside. The other issue with this treatment is they can cause a huge amount of side effects. When you non-specifically activate T cells, they can kill anything, right? So you can get a lot of inflammatory and autoimmune side effects. So what these researchers have done is they have made this very targeted just to prostate cells. So it's bispecific. One, it binds to the killer T cells, but it then only binds to something that's found on prostate cells. So that's already very clever. But then they've made sure that it's only activated in the tumor microenvironment. The reason tumors survive, or one of the reasons, is they can create their own environment, like the way Wexford is always sunny. They can basically create a way that it dampens down all the immune responses just in their environment, so they survive. But with that brings ways to manipulate them. So when this drug gets to the tumor microenvironment, it uses the proteins that are in the microenvironment to activate itself. Then it becomes active only at the site of the tumor. It targets the tumor and it has very few side effects. And with the 58 men that it looked at, the effects were very dramatic. One man had 14 metastatic lesions from his prostate cancer in his liver, and they all resolved after 6 cycles. That's so rare that that's case study type things. You know, that is not the kind of thing that you see frequently. Pretty much everybody had a reduction in their PSA levels. And it's so hopeful and so exciting. And I don't think that this is the kind of thing we're talking about in 15 or 20 years. I think this will hopefully be useful within 5 years in mainstream medicine if the phase 2 and 3 trials go well.
Yeah, phase 1, just to remind people, is just testing to make sure that it's safe. And then phase 3 is where you're actually testing it in large numbers of people to see whether or not it works and can be commercialized. And you got a huge amount of data to work with to make sure that this is something that we should be using in medicine. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially that's it.
Roughly, yeah, yeah. Always good to check when I make these blanket statements. Our final story, Ruth, has to do with NASA. And all this talk about sending people to the moon is rather disappointingly been turned upside down.
Yeah, it's proving much, much harder than maybe many people would think it should to send people back to the moon. So NASA... It's been 50 years since we sent people to the moon. And it's quite incredible, with 50 years of advancement in technology, we are really finding it very, very difficult. So the Apollo program was the original program that sent people to the moon. So NASA a few years ago decided through the Artemis program that they would send humans back to the moon. And so Artemis 1 went up in 2022. A new Orion spacecraft, and that just flew by the moon, and it did that successfully, and then the capsule came back down to Earth. So we were waiting for Artemis 2 to go up in the next couple of weeks. So this was going to send humans. That was the next big advancement. So it was still going to be a fly by the moon, but 4 astronauts were going to go up in the Artemis 2 spacecraft, and then the idea was Artemis 3 would actually land on the moon. But NASA has announced just this week that plans have changed, because during the wet dress rehearsal, which is what I believe they call it, they found some issues with the rocket. So they had a hydrogen leak, a fuel leak when they did the first test. Yeah, not good. And then they also found an issue with some of the helium propellant as well in the more recent test. So they had actually got the astronauts to go into quarantine, because they really thought they were going to be ready to launch in the next couple of weeks. But now it looks like it will be April at the earliest that Artemis 2 will go up. And they have also announced that Artemis 3 will not land on the moon. So that was going to be probably 2028. But now it looks like Artemis 3 will again be kind of a flyby, and it will be Artemis 4 that will potentially land on the moon. So we're getting out to probably 2030 by the time that's going to happen. So significant delay.
Yeah, which is really a shame for anyone who wants to have their, you know, their love of space exploration sort of reignited by seeing people, you know, land on the moon, which, you know, I guess for the next generation, it will kind of feel like 1969 all over again, right? And we'll probably feel like that. But it's crazy. I never understood the idea of putting humans in a flyby on the moon. It's so close. Surely we know enough to be able to just stick them on the moon when we do. Surely we can put enough equipment on the plane, on the probe, to understand what might happen to real humans. I don't know. It would just be looking out the window while you pass them in by. It seems like the least fulfilling space exploration mission. But, you know, it's all part of the machine again.
Yeah, and I guess they're trying to go to the South Pole this time. They're, you know, not just you know, landing, planting a flag and getting off. So they do want to do something that's more complicated. So they are taking their time, you know, to get that right. And they're also really trying to follow the safety standards that they've been set. You know, a report came out from NASA, which really did raise red flags. But still, you know, the other thing is they lost so much talent out of NASA. Like back in the 70s, NASA was getting 4% of the US, the whole sort of country's budget, 4% went in. It now gets 0.04. Wow. And they just lost a huge amount of skills when the space program was wound down. So, you know, they're sort of having to build that back up again.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Ruth Freeman and Dr. Laura Dungan, thank you very much as always. Take a moment to just take a breath. Really, do it properly. Breathe deeply through your nose. This is something that we do 25,000 times a day. Inhale, exhale, repeat. It's the most automatic thing that we do. And yet, according to science journalist James Nestor, we're spectacularly bad at it. His New York Times bestselling book, Breath, argues that how we breathe could be the missing pillar of health, influencing everything from anxiety to asthma to snoring, sleep apnea, and even the shape of our faces. He joins us now. James, it's great to have you on the program. I picked up your book when I was in France about 2 years ago. And it got me in trouble because as I started reading it, I couldn't stop reading it. And I was late to pick up the kids from school. This book is extraordinary because of the things that you did in it, but also the claims in it and the simple obviousness of some of the arguments that you make. So let's start off by talking about what is wrong with how we breathe.
Basically everything. If you look at the rates of chronic respiratory dysfunction around the world, you find that the vast majority of people are suffering from it. And that can manifest in asthma or COPD, but it can also manifest in simpler, less noticeable chronic maladies like mouth breathing or mild snoring. So this was something that just absolutely floored me when I first learned about it so many years ago from a few different scientists. They say, as a species, humans are terrible breathers, and it's one of the reasons why so many of us are suffering from so many problems.
When it comes to the way we breathe, a lot of us do breathe through our mouths for various different reasons. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's fine as a backup system, right? If you're congested, if you break your nose, we have the mouth as a backup system. But the mouth was never designed to be the primary pathway through which we should breathe. There are about 35 different functions that the nose serves, from increasing the oxygenation in each breath to fighting bacteria and viruses when we breathe in and out of the nose, to calming the nervous system. And this isn't some sort of new age mumbo jumbo. This has been documented in so many different scientific studies over decades and decades. The thing that's strange to me is that even though the science is very clear and the data's there, the awareness for the general public isn't. And I was certainly somebody who was a terrible breather for most of my life.
You, in the book, detail some unusual experiments to try and test this out. Maybe you might tell us about some of the things that you went through to try and examine the effect of just mouth breathing, for example, or the effect of breathing on various activities and health outcomes.
So I had been studying and talking to so many researchers over so many years about all of the damage that mouth breathing could do to the body, to focus, to sleep, and more. And there's no real dispute about that. The data is all over the place, and it's very clear. But I did not know.
So you're talking about improved cognitive function, improved memory. What are the specifics?
I'm talking about everything. So from cognitive function to executive functions, to making better emotional decisions, to performing better on tests, to having less respiratory illness, to having lower blood pressure. I mean, I could go on and on down this laundry list of 100 different benefits of nasal breathing. And that's been in the scientific record for a very long time. But I wanted to know and wanted to experience personally the difference between these two things. So I was able to work with a scientist at Stanford, and we built an experiment in which for 10 days, I was an obligate mouth breather. And then for 10 days, I was breathing most of my breaths through my nose. And we took data the entire time, three times a day, and just looked at the difference between those two pathways.
And so what did you see in that data? Because it seems like a very short amount of time. And of course, it's N equals one. So, mm-hmm. you know, you have one subject of that particular study. But just looking from that little anecdote, that was the thing that really caught me. I was looking at what you were saying, and I was thinking, my God, that seems enormous. Well, what exactly happened?
Well, I tried to get about 50 people in this study, and I petitioned for this for months and months and months, but there was no funding to do it. So the researcher I was working with allowed me to have two people. You know, two people is not optimum. You should have 50 or 100 or 2,000 if you can. But
that's right. There's two of you.
That's the absolute limit that his lab would take. And he said he didn't want more people to do it because he felt that it would compromise his ethics because he knew all of the damage that will be caused by mouth breathing. What we didn't know was how quickly that damage comes on. And so that's what we were just trying to experience. I don't even call this a study. We call it an experiment, right? Because it's just two people. But what we found confirmed all of those scientific studies, all of them. And the thing that took the biggest hit the most quickly was sleep, was the quality of sleep, was snoring, was sleep apnea. It just came on immediately. And it grew worse and worse every day as long as we were mouth breathing.
And you essentially sort of taped yourself off for each of these experiments, essentially.
Yeah, we ate the same food. We walked the same amount of steps. We really took it seriously, went to bed at the same time. So it was as controlled as we could make it outside of being in a lab. And the data was irrefutable. I don't snore. I don't have sleep apnea. Within a single night of becoming a mouth breather, I was snoring an hour and a half. And a few days after that, I was snoring through most of the night. And that snoring kept up as long as I was mouth breathing. And this is one of the reasons why so many people during allergy season, sleep apnea and snoring go through the roof. And what so many people don't know is that the pathway through which you breathe air has a huge influence on how much you snore. And for some people, even if you snore or not.
Some of the stuff in the book, I tried out myself. I was cycling at the time in the Alps, and I was really interested to hear that some of the claims of the book about athletic performance increasing significantly. There's been a bit of pushback from the initial book. I know this. There's been a newer, updated version of the book released. I'm just wondering where you sit with that. I mean, in terms of the athletic performance, because everybody's looking for an edge. And of course, people also want to be able to exercise for longer, run faster, or whatever it is they want to do. How have you settled into the talk about athletic performance?
Well, I think the record is there. And, you know, as a science journalist, it's not my job to go out and collect my own research and collect my own data. It's my job to go talk to the absolute leaders in the field of each of the disciplines in which I'm writing. And so one of the things I did is I talked to elite trainers of Olympians, of football stars, of tennis players. And they said that the number one thing that they do for their athletes right now is they look at their breathing, and almost all of them are breathing dysfunctionally. And by improving breathing, you're improving your efficiency. You're able to do more with less energy. And that's what competition is all about. And athletic trainers have been doing this with swimmers, with sprinters, with bicyclists, and more for so long, for decades and decades. And what I've heard from most people is what an incredible difference it makes to lock in your respiratory rate with the level of your activity and to be able to relax more, whether you're cycling, whether you're running, whether you're playing football.
Let's talk a bit about breathing correctly then, because we talked about mouth breathing, but that's not really the only thing. There are other ways to improve how we breathe. What else is wrong with how we breathe?
Well, if you're like me and you spend most of your time indoors in front of a computer working away, there's a very good chance you're sitting down. And if you're sitting down, there's a very good chance your posture is a disaster. So by a disaster, I mean your spine is curved, you're hunched over. So even if you wanted to take a deep breath of air, you can't, because the biomechanics aren't there for it. If anyone's listening to this in a car, on a train, sitting in an office right now, you can just take a huge breath of air in through your nose.
All right.
And feel what happens to your posture. Feel what happens to your spine. So that is how we're supposed to be sitting. That's how we're supposed to be standing. And as so many different therapists know, our posture is a disaster because we're spending 90% of our times indoors. So that's the very first thing, is to look at your posture and to be able to effortlessly take that deep breath we just took without feeling any strain in your spine or anything. Mm. The next thing you can do is you can take your hand and place it just below your belly button. And as you inhale through the nose, you should feel a slight expansion of that belly area, that abdominal area. And as you exhale, that belly should be coming in. And from what I've seen in my own experience is that the vast majority of people don't breathe this way because we're very subconscious about our waist. We don't want our belly sticking out at all. But if you look at any other animal, especially animals in the wild that aren't in a house, that aren't in a zoo, and you look at how they're breathing, this is how they're breathing all the time. And humans were designed to breathe the same way.
So it feels like breathing correctly sort of puts our body in the right position, and that it's the position that can have lots of other effects, in the same way as breathing through our nose gives us better sleep. And so there's sort of a trickle down effect of health that comes from the way we breathe, is what you're saying.
I think that if you look at your breath as both a regulator of nervous system function, but also a reaction to nervous system function, you also have to fold into that equation the rate in which you're breathing. So you want to be breathing slow, fluid, full breaths. This seems so simple and it seems so intuitive. And yet the vast majority of us are breathing into our chest. We're not taking those deep breaths. We're breathing way too much. And when we breathe way too much, that sends signals to our brain that we are stressed. So we stay in this vicious cycle of stress. And most of those breaths for...
Wait. You say breathe too much. What do you mean breathe too much?
You heard me. Breathe too much and breathe too often.
Too often. Okay.
No, but breathing too much is a problem. You're not getting more oxygen when you are over breathing. This is again, so counterintuitive, but this is what several pulmonologists told me. So we can just go into that a little bit because I know this seems crazy to people. Right now, if you were, and don't do this if you're driving, but if you were to take about 20 very deep, very fast breaths, hyperventilate. So you would think that you're like, well, I just took all those breaths. I am oxygenating my body. I'm getting more air into my body. You're actually doing the opposite. You're making it harder for your body to deliver oxygen to all of your hungry cells. The reason is you are blowing off too much carbon dioxide. And the reason why your hands start tingling, your head gets cloudy and it starts tingling and you feel cold, is because all of those blood vessels throughout your body are clenching up. So when we are constantly over breathing, we are closing the plumbing throughout our body. And that's why we have all of these sensations. So by breathing more slowly and fluidly and deeply, we deliver much more oxygen much more efficiently than we do when we're over breathing, or we're breathing too much, either at a too fast of a rate or just too much air.
What about how our breathing has shaped our jaws and how that's had a trickle-down effect?
Yeah, so our jaws have mostly shaped our breathing. Those two things go back and forth. This was something that I did not ever expect to be writing about, especially on a book about breathing. And for the first few years that I was researching this book, I never heard of this. And when I heard it, I thought there's no way this could have been true, because I would have heard about it in college or in high school or in grammar school. It's so basic. And yet I didn't. And yet it's clearly, the science is there. It's a clear fact. And that fact is that the human mouth, over the past around 300, 400 years, has been growing smaller and smaller and smaller, so much so that our teeth no longer fit in our mouths. That's why we have crooked teeth. It's not a tooth problem. It's because our mouths are growing smaller and smaller and smaller. And with that small mouth, it's harder to breathe. We have a smaller pipe, and this is one of the drivers for so much of snoring and sleep apnea and even anxiety, because people can't breathe properly because their mouths are too small.
And so when you say they're too, why have they gotten too small?
The eternal question. This was the question that I was confronted with early on. And I asked these researchers. I was at this lab in Philadelphia where they have hundreds and hundreds of ancient skulls from all over the world. Doesn't matter. You could pick them from Asia, from Africa, from Europe. All of our ancestors had straight teeth, okay? And they had these huge pronathic, these forward-growing faces. And you look at these ancient skulls, and they almost look like a different species from those of us today. And so a bunch of different researchers have been asking this question, like, how did this happen? This isn't an evolutionary advantage, right? It's a disadvantage. It's making us sick. We don't want crooked teeth. And what they found was that the moment industrialized processed foods came into a society, within a single generation, 50% of that population had crooked teeth, 50%. Next generation, 70. Next generation, 80%. Next generation, here we are, 90% of us have some crookedness in our teeth. So it's the consistency of food is the primary driver. All of that stuff from the Victorian era was bottled, was canned, was baked, was processed, was boiled. It doesn't require any chewing. And without chewing, the skeleton, musculature doesn't develop and you grow a small mouth, just like me, just like everyone else I know.
It's a really fascinating book that takes you down all of these different avenues, and there's lots of interesting characters along the way. I'm stretching my back while I'm speaking to you, James, and trying to breathe more deeply. So let's finish up with something useful for people, because I would love for people to hear this and actually learn how to breathe more properly. So how should we be breathing?
So the first thing you need to learn how to do is to take most of your breaths in and out of your nose. You can take some breaths through your mouth when you're laughing. Maybe if you're even working out at level 4, level 5, zone 4, zone 5, you can default to that. But most of the breaths during the day should be in and out through the nose. And all of your breaths when you're sleeping should be in and out through the nose. This is the number one foundational first step.
How do you teach yourself to do that? Like, how on earth am I supposed to teach myself? Because I'm thinking about it a lot. How do I force myself to do it when I'm not thinking about it?
I knew you were going to ask for specifics. So there is no blanket prescription here. Everyone is suffering from something just a slightly different from their neighbor, right? So some people need surgery, right? That's the only, they have such a clearly deviated system that they need surgery. For some people, it's a habit. For some people, they need to get rid of their allergies that keep them constantly congested. There are hundreds of different reasons why people are mouth breathing. So we don't have time to get into that, but trust me, you have to find your core issue and fix it, because this is going to make an incredible difference to your health and well-being, to your mental clarity, to your physical endurance and more. So that's the number one thing, is to become an obligate nasal breather. For those of you who are just breathing through the mouth out of habit, you can set 6 or 7 alarms that go off on your phone, just a little chime to remind you to close your mouth. And after a few weeks, you develop a habit, and then you won't need any of these tricks or these bells or whistles. That will become your new default. I was a mouth breather my whole life. It took me about 5 to 6 weeks to really train myself. Now I never, ever do it, ever. Even when I'm working out, even when I'm surfing, it has become my default habit. So nasal breathing, that's number one. I talked about proper biomechanics, right? Proper posture, basically. So you can take that effortless, deep breath through your nose and feel that slight expansion in your belly area. And then when you exhale, it comes back in. And the last thing of the most basic steps here is to learn to breathe slowly and rhythmically. This is very important if you ever go to altitude. Everyone talks about altitude sickness. What is it caused from? It's primarily caused by overbreathing. Overbreathing, because that is denying you of oxygen. There's been so many studies that have shown the slower you breathe, the deeper you breathe, the fewer breaths you take, your oxygen levels go way up to 9 points. So breathing slowly, rhythmically will also send messages to your nervous system, to your brain, that you are calm and in control. So if you can do those three things, then we can go down, you know, a whole bunch of other things that you can do to fine tune your breathing. But those are the primary ones.
Well, the book is called Breath. It is definitely worth a look. James Nestor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. We spoke to Steve Beebe from the University of Southampton about e-textiles, this idea that the clothes of the future may have electronics woven into them. Someone says, has his team had to create new materials or fabrication techniques to allow flexible electronic circuits? So he has found a way to coat the clothes, but the problem is when you wash clothing, those circuits, because they're supposed to be flexible and light and not, you know, essentially be a whole suit made of wires, they don't wash very well. And that is the big bottleneck for him, he said. Someone says, I have my doubts about the ability to monitor physiological signals non-invasively. I disagree. I think it's really interesting when you look at things like being able to look at the eye for general systemic health, or if you look at someone's gait, you can tell so much from someone's gait by the way they walk. You can identify them. You can have a good idea of what sort of level of health they're at. If you put all of these things together, all of the signals that our bodies give off, heat, heart rate, all that sort of stuff, I think you're going to get quite a detailed and rich picture of someone's health. And someone else says, have they thought much about the environmental sustainability of e-textiles, particularly regarding end-of-life recycling? Good question. Doesn't sound like it's a particularly recyclable fabric. So be interesting to see how you square that circle, because the European Union in particular doesn't want you making products that you can't disassemble. So that'll be a question for future problems, I imagine. That's it for this episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan producing, Rory Galvin on podcasts, and Hugo da Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.